That's season one music, which means it's time for a Merritt and Karen update. But first, in other true crime news, you may have heard that a cipher written by the Zodiac Killer more than 50 years ago has finally been cracked by amateur code breakers. During his or her killing spree between 1968 and 1969, the still unidentified Zodiac Killer sent a series of letters to the San Francisco Chronicle. Portions of those communications were written in cipher, a code, which until December of 2020 remained unbroken. As the UK Independent wrote, quote, "Solving the Zodiac cipher has become an international fixation for true crime followers." Three private citizens have finally cracked that code, though the results were less than helpful. The first line of the infamous 340 cipher reads, "I hope you are having lots of fun trying to catch me." All in all, the decoded messages contain misspellings that confirm they were almost certainly written by the Zodiac Killer, but they mostly turn out to be 50-year-old taunts, and they are unlikely to help identify the killer. Of course, the Merritt and Karen case has its own cipher. On this episode, the mystical copper plate discovered in 1970 and submitted as evidence in the Merritt and Karen case has now been decoded by our co-producer Sarah and an academic working on magical texts halfway around the world. For what it's worth, this episode was already recorded when the news of the Zodiac Killer's code broke. But in the case of the copper plate found in West Virginia, an actual story is uncovered. A real historical character makes a mythological pact with a demon, while a mythical Morgantown character becomes more real than ever. It's a wild ride. From Chromatic Media and Jam Street Media, this is Appalachian Mysteria. We first talked about the mystical copper plate in Season 1, Episode 2. Sarah and Jeff were telling us about some of the creepy things people were finding in the area just after the headless bodies of Merritt and Karen were discovered. Here's a couple of quick sound clips from that episode to get you back in the swing of the story.
People were saying, hey, we found weird things that were made out of rocks in the woods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there was apparently a sighting of someone found a rock stones made into a triangle, and in the middle of that triangle was a stick with a burlap bag suspended from it, a small burlap bag like a bindle stiff. No one seems to know what that was or what it was doing there. There was a copper plate found with a lot of mystical symbols, astrological symbols, and Greek writing and various things, and some spooky eyes with
weird eyebrows
that made it look like Satan.
Here we took a brief pause to note that Sarah's pagan friend said they looked more like antlers, but the plate also contained
a magic square, which is a term from mysticism, supposedly going back to the days of alchemy. And there were an 8-pointed star and a 6-pointed star, I think. And there were just a mishmash of mystical symbols hand-carved into a copper plate.
And finally, Jeff reminded us that there was a reason things like this were looked at seriously during that time.
Rumors about mystical involvement in cults, because of the Manson thing happening, the Zodiac thing happening on the West Coast, there's a murder of a guy's whole family, supposedly by hippies that were tripping and chanting mystical symbols and waving candles. So, mystical murder was on the minds of everybody around the country. It was very big at the time.
We had a photocopy of this plate up on the website for a long time, and we've just recently taken it down to hide some of the lettering for reasons that will become apparent later in this story. But if you want to see an edited version of the plate while listening to this episode, we're posting it right now to our Facebook pages for Appalachian Mysteria and Chromatic Media. Feel free to follow along with us and like the pages while you're there to help keep up with new material. For those who aren't interested in doing that, I'll take a quick moment for a description here. The plate itself was small, but the version we've been looking at is an enlarged photocopy negative of the plate. So my actual physical print of this image is an 8x10 sheet of paper in portrait orientation, and the whole page is black, except for the white carvings made by an unknown person. For me, this image of the plate is definitely one of the most visually striking to come out of the case. Even though the FBI report we have on the plate didn't make clear where it was found or how it was related to the investigation of Merritt and Karen, I've always just thought of it as a really cool piece of local occult history and left it at that. Sarah, however, was determined to figure out what those words meant and how they were connected to the case. And since I had almost nothing to do with that, today's episode will mostly be a conversation between Sarah and this guy.
Great. So I'm Korshi Dosu, and I work on ancient magical texts written in Coptic and Greek and Demotic.
So modest, you left out doctor.
Dr. Korshi Dosu, I suppose.
At the time Sarah was trying to decode the mystical plate, she was using Google Translate for letters that appeared to be Greek. The FBI report on the plate mentions that one of the only Greek words they could translate was the word Coptic, which is the name of an ancient Egyptian language. When looking for information on Coptic Egyptian ritual magic, Dr. Korshi Dosu lands at the top of your Google results. He's the team leader of the project, The Coptic Magical Papyri, Vernacular Religion in Late Roman and Early Islamic Egypt. That project is centered at the Julius Maximilian University of Würzburg. Korshi lives in Paris, works in Germany, speaks four languages, and knows quite a bit about ancient magic, rituals, and Coptic, which Korshi summarizes like this.
By about the 4th century of our era, maybe the 3rd century of our era, a lot of Egypt started to convert to Christianity. And when they were translating the Bible and some other texts, they decided to use a different alphabet, essentially, to write it in. They didn't want to use hieroglyphs or hieratic or demotic, which were associated perhaps with paganism. So instead, they used an alphabet which was based on the Greek script. And so that's what Coptic is. It's basically the Egyptian language written in a predominantly Greek script.
Around the time Sarah first wrote Korshi, she made a trip to the library where she found a book titled A Coptic Handbook of Ritual Power. She was using the book to research Coptic lettering in different alphabet styles, comparing them to the symbols on the plate.
Some were very similar and some were not. And when I finally found one that was similar, I realized that this wasn't going to translate normally. And so I Googled and I found your organization, which you are team leader of, for the University of Würzburg. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And I really didn't think I would get a response. thought, I'm filling this out on the internet. This is some form and I'm going to forget about this because no one's ever going to look at it. And you actually responded to me.
Yeah, it took me a little while. It was actually a really funny coincidence that you did realize it was Coptic, because the FBI didn't. They were trying to read it as Greek. And the word they read as Coptic wasn't actually Coptic. So it's a really big coincidence that somehow they got that part almost right by accident and you happened to look up at our project.
This would turn out to be only the first of several strange coincidences. There were three major challenges in decoding this plate. First, you have to take into account the condition of the image that we have access to.
I don't know that people are really going to understand. Not only is this sort of a unique language that this person is writing in, but also we have a really terrible Xerox copy of a Xerox copy. There are spots where it's just black and you can't really tell if there's a symbol there, if it's half a symbol. It's really difficult.
I think the original thing is actually pretty small, right? It's about 4 by 5 inches, so it's not much bigger than a hand, and there's quite a lot of text on this.
The second challenge was that whoever made the plate wasn't exactly fluent in Coptic.
It's a little bit like when kids learn to write English. They sometimes, they might write an A, but they'll do the stock too big and it'll actually look like a D, if that makes sense. It's a little bit like that. It's somebody who isn't used to writing Coptic, trying to write Coptic.
And finally, as I mentioned, the connection of the plate to the investigation is totally unclear. It just appears in the evidence without description of how it came into police custody or why.
We weren't sure where it came up. We were under the assumption that it was found while they were searching for things in the woods.
Yeah, which would be very creepy if it was buried with these two dead girls.
Right. We had no idea what they were in relation to this case, but also where they were found in relation to where the bodies were found.
Yeah, and that's actually something else, because the ancient curse tablets, they were very often buried with dead bodies, particularly people who'd been murdered or had died violently, because the idea was that their ghost would kind of be hanging around that area and you could get their ghost to do something nasty for you.
The FBI report Sarah forwarded to Corshi contained 20 pages of analysis. Whoever wrote the report started with the lettering at the top of the plate. It reads, quote, "At the top, there are what appears to be three words written vertically. The vertical word on the left appears to be the Greek word for Coptic, and the center vertical word appears to be the Greek word for logic." But Corshi started his decryption in the same place, and it wasn't long until those vertical words translated as Coptic and logic shaped up to be something much more interesting.
So I got this kind of strange email in the middle of my holiday, and I kind of thought of it as a kind of interesting challenge, I suppose. So after staring, to be honest, at the letters for a very long time, I managed to figure out what two of the words were. And I realized it was actually, kind of English. It was a name, right? So it wasn't actually Coptic or Greek or Latin. It was a name from in a modern English form. And so I managed to read two of the three names. And I think that's what I sent back to you, that I'd managed to figure out what two of the names were. But I couldn't figure out the third one.
Right. So you found out that it was a first and middle and last name. And since you discovered it and this person wants to remain incognito, I was like, hey, you discovered her. You get to choose the name that we're gonna refer to her as. Did you pick one?
Yeah, I decided to go with Debbie.
Debbie?
Yeah. How does that sound?
Oh, that's fine. I mean, that's my mom's name. That's not
oh,
weird.
Oh, sorry.
At all.
Okay. I was thinking of Debbie Harry because I'm a big Blondie fan.
No, it's all right, Debbie. I'll remember Debbie.
Okay.
This is why we've edited out the three rows of symbols at the top of the plate. They actually spell out a woman's full name. After Corshi wrote Sarah, telling her that he'd been able to translate the middle name and last name, only one remained.
That's right, yeah. And then after staring at it for maybe another day or two, I realized what the first name was. I read the Debbie part of it. So when I first saw it and I couldn't really make much head or tail of it, I kind of despaired of figuring it out. But then I think once I got the second and last name, I realized that it was actually decipherable. Then I got the first name and then I was kind of hungry to try to figure out more.
And just to reiterate here, you were on vacation. You were just doing this to your friend.
Yeah, my partner wasn't very happy with me. But I think that's the disadvantage of being in a relationship with an academic. They're kind of always working even when they're not. But eventually it became a fun thing for us. So me and all my friends were kind of talking about this case and how we were going to crack it while we were in the swimming pool.
While you're in the swimming pool, that's great.
If you're looking at the plate along with us, you can see that under those three vertical rows where the name appeared, there was a horizontal box with long series of etchings. Corshi focused his attention there next and recognized a pattern from something he'd seen before.
There's a word on in the middle part, which is lipra, which doesn't really mean anything in any language I know. But then I realized if you read it backwards, it was April. And then we have like a series of very strange symbols, which I didn't recognize at first. But I was in this seminar a while ago where we were reading this papyrus, which is basically an account. Somebody had been buying cloth or something like that. And at the bottom, they'd done all these little symbols where they were keeping track of what different kinds of cloth they'd bought. So they bought maybe 10 of one type and 15 of another. And that kind of reminded me of this. So I basically just counted the number of different symbols. So I realized that we had, if you just wrote them down as numbers, you had 1958. And once I figured that out, I realized that, you know, some were hundreds, some were tens, some were units. And I realized it was actually the ancient Egyptian numeral system. Although we later realized that 1958 was too late. And so it was actually 1951. And then the seven extra ones at the end were actually the time of day that the person was born. So it was actually 7 a.m. And so it was 1951, 7 a.m. And then a date in April.
And this is where it got really exciting for me, because once you had all three names and a birth date, I knew I could find the person.
Yeah, that was very impressive. I think you did it within a couple of days, actually.
I tracked down Debbie and I was basically squealing. I actually called Kendall and he can attest to this. I was like, I just have to unload how exciting this is. I found the person. She's on this plate. I don't know if she designed it or whatever, but like we have a name and we have a date. And she graduated the same year as the co-eds in Morgantown, West Virginia. And then she went to WVU. So This was huge to me. I mean, I was like shrill and really annoying on the phone about it. And Kendall was really cool about it. He was excited too. So we were like, well, should we reach out to her? And I wanted to, but I think I called like 3 or 4 different numbers that I found for her, and all of them were disconnected. They were really just like old phone numbers. And so I said, I'm going to take this as a sign that we need to find out more about the plate first. And then I will contact her when I can tell enough about the plate to either give her something about it or know what questions to ask.
Continuing work on the plate from the top down, we next have the Sator Square, which Jeff earlier referred to as a magical square. You can basically imagine a 5x5 grid of letters that spells out different magical words whichever way you read the lines. Early on, the top line was often Sator, S-A-T-O-R, but eventually its anadrome, Rotus, became fairly common as well.
Sator Square is it's very old symbol. So I think the first attestation of it we have is in the 1st century in some graffiti from Pompeii. Where it is actually in Latin. And nobody really knows exactly what it means. It's just kind of this cool thing that people discovered that they could write these 5 words, and it would create, as you say, a palindrome and an anadrome. But I think it gradually just became associated with magic generally. And so I guess the person who made the plate probably just thought of it as a magical sign that they could incorporate.
What Corshi's getting at is that the square is more a long-standing traditional sort of magical symbol, and there was no specific information to be gained there about the plate or who made it or why. Scattered around the Sator Square were 3 magical symbols that Corshi couldn't quite put his finger on.
Yeah, so we were trying to figure out the symbols, and I was like, oh, well, I don't have time to do this. And I to be honest, I was very skeptical that we would find those symbols because, you know, like they're just scribbles and anybody can make up a new sigil whenever they like. But I did manage to find this dictionary of magical symbols, and I sent it to you to look through. And to be honest, I didn't think you were going to find anything.
I think that dictionary is what, like 400 pages?
It's a big dictionary. Yeah, that's why I sent it to you, because I didn't have time to look through it myself.
Like, it should have felt like a punishment, but I was like, ooh, symbols.
So Sarah's looking through this enormous text, Dictionary of Occult, Hermetic, Alchemical, Sigils, and Symbols, by Fred Gettings, hoping to find something similar to those 3 inscriptions around the Sator Square. About halfway through the book, she discovered one, but it wasn't an astrological symbol like the others. This was the sigil of a demon. The sigil was associated with the demon Mephistopheles. The fallen angel first appears in a German legend based on a real person named Faust, who lived in the early 1500s. In the legend that appeared after his death, Faust is successful but unhappy with his life. He desires magical power desperately, and after a failed suicide attempt, he calls on the devil in a desperate plea for immense knowledge and pleasure, which he assumes will make him happy. The demon Mephistopheles appears on behalf of the devil and makes that bargain for power in exchange for Faust's soul. Mephistopheles made sure that Faust's death was horrific. One text about his death reads, quote, "At daybreak, they ventured into his room. Bloodstains were everywhere. Bits of brain clung to the walls. Here they discovered an eye and there a few teeth. Outside they found the corpse, its members still twitching, lying on a manure pile." Faust is basically the archetype of modern deal-with-the-devil stories. Mephistopheles has several sigils and seals. In fact, one seal attributed to the demon contains a disembodied human head in its design. And there are several versions of Mephistopheles in various works of literature by different authors in which he appears in different forms.
Each one of the forms had different sigils, and so
yeah.
The form where he is a friar had each one of them, I mean, bam, 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 all 3 of those symbols that were around the square. And I was like, oh, shit, that's it. That is it. And I like, you know, like cut it out, like did a copy and paste and sent it to you. And I was like, booyah. And then I'm like, okay, so what's this mean? This seems bad. Is this bad?
One additional mystery about all this is where someone would have found this information in 1970 West Virginia. The dictionary had taken these sigils from a rather obscure text.
So basically this was like a 19th century book of German magic, or it was a book of German magic published in the 19th century in 1848 by a guy called Johann Schaubel. And yeah, basically, as you say, it was like a series of rituals for summoning demons. And like, it was very easy for us to find the book. So the book is actually called like Faust's Journey to Hell, basically. It's quite easy for us to find it. We could just Google it and we could find like a PDF version online. But this is like a book that was published in 1848. So I guess in a small town in West Virginia, it probably wasn't that easy to get a copy of it. Yeah, but it was very, very surprising.
At this point, there's only one part of the plate left to discuss, the other long horizontal box of etchings down at the bottom.
That was sort of like the breakthrough part.
Yeah, so I think from the beginning, I'd been able to read like the occasional letter here and there, but it just didn't make any sense. And that's one of the parts that's hardest to read. Like, there's some letters that you don't really see any of it. But once I kind of knew that the middle part, the date, was written backwards, it made it easier to figure it out. So I gradually, I think it took me three or four goes to figure out exactly what it said. But I realized that it said something like, freedom to choose personal code of life and happiness.
This delighted Sarah, of course. She was like,
holy shit, there's actually a message here.
Yeah, yeah. And it's actually, so the top line is written backwards, but the next line is written in the normal direction. So it kind of goes in a zigzagging shape, in a sense, which made it even more complicated. So I think that at that point, I kind of had this theory that maybe the person who made it, and I think at that point, I was pretty sure it must have been Debbie herself, because it seemed like she was the only person who would know when she was, the hour in which she was born, apart from her parents. That she'd maybe made this to get freedom to live her own personal code of life and happiness, and that maybe she thought of it as some kind of contract with Mephistopheles, whose name was written on it.
So with nearly every symbol on the plate accounted for, Sarah decided it was time to reach out to Debbie. While the phone numbers she'd gathered had failed, she also managed to find Debbie on a social media platform and sent a message, again unsure if she would ever hear back.
She actually responded, and I had written that I wanted to talk to her about something that had happened in 1970 regarding something that was found. And so when I talked to her, she knew exactly what I was talking about.
Wow. Did she know before you mentioned it that that's what you would be talking about?
She did, because she looked me up and that she found that I was part of this podcast. And so she's like, I knew exactly what you wanted to talk about. And I almost didn't reach out to you. And then I decided that I would to help you with your research.
Wow. Just before you called, Debbie, we thought that it was like some kind of ritual that she'd carried out so that she would have freedom to, you know, to do what she wanted to do with her life. And we thought that maybe she'd accidentally got herself pregnant. And it was like a way to get herself out of this situation, because it could have been a rough position to be in for, you know, a young girl in the 70s? Yeah, 1970, yeah.
Right. Well, it would have been very difficult for her, like, if she had been pregnant, and that would have made sense. Like, it would have taken a desperate situation, in my opinion, for her to have put her name with the Grand Duke of Hell.
Yeah, I tried to make a deal with the devil. Yeah.
So I did think that either she was pregnant or she was, you know, like, perhaps she was gay, and it's not really acceptable in 1970 in her surroundings, and maybe she was just asking for her life to be a little less hectic about following her heart. And so I started asking her questions about the plate, and we were way off with what we were thinking the origins of it were.
Over a conversation with Debbie, Sarah learned that she'd had almost no part in the creation of the plate, other than a couple of encounters with a mysterious man on the WVU campus.
She had met someone in the student union, which I think is what we would refer to the Mountain Layer now. And he had wanted to know her date of birth, because he wanted to create something that would help her decipher what her future was.
The man was known in Morgantown as Black Michael. If you've been listening to Chromatic Media podcasts for a while now, that name might sound familiar. In 2018, we produced a one-episode special titled Cradle Will Rock, about Harry Spitz, a young Morgantown boy whose grave exploded in 1976. Aside from the enigma of the explosion, the somehow undisturbed casket was then opened to reveal the body of a child seemingly untouched by decay after being buried for more than 60 years. There was simply no reasonable explanation for the events, and so, as they tend to do, explanations turned to the supernatural. Here's a short clip from that episode in which the character of Black Michael, creator of the mystical plate, shows up. In this clip, I also mentioned Jordan. That's Jordan Carter, the co-producer of that episode. What about the possibility of the paranormal? One report claimed that Chief Palmer was sometimes forced to send officers into the cemetery to chase away a group of spiritualists who held meetings and seances there. Jordan spent weeks looking for anyone connected to this group, and was eventually offered the name Black Michael, a man who owned an occult bookstore in Sunnyside, the same storefront where Snacks, a convenience store, once was. Merritt and Karen used to stop at Snacks and talk with photojournalist Ron Rittenhouse. Black Michael was a suspect in the Merritt and Karen investigation for a short time, but he had an alibi and was quickly discounted. According to Black Michael's former employee, protege, and current friend, quote, Black Michael had nothing to do with any seances in Oak Grove. Seances were beneath Michael's dignity. He was a magician. He is actually a very God is the light of consciousness type. He hated people thinking that wearing black meant that he was a Satanist. The funny thing is, he led a low-profile life. All the people who knew him are dead or gone. I'll bet those people could research till the cows come home, and all they get is silly rumors.
Please don't talk about me when I'm gone. Oh, honey, though our friendship ceases from now on. And listen, if you can't say anything real nice, it's better not to talk at all, is my advice.
Again, that's from our one episode special, Cradle Will Rock. As you just heard, the Copper Plate is now the third time Black Michael has come up in our work on Morgantown Stories. We'd never even been sure of his real name or whether he's alive until April of 2020, when he published a book about his life and beliefs. The title, Black Michael's Search for a True God. The name of the author on the cover, Michael Oscar McKee.
Yeah, so I had a little bit of a read of it.
What was your impression there?
Well, he seems like a very, very, how should I put this? He seems like a real individual, I suppose. Like, it doesn't seem like he's based this on anything that existed before. It seems like he really just really plunged himself into reading lots and lots of esoteric and ancient texts and kind of came up with this on his own based on that. And that's kind of what you get from reading his book, that he's reading a lot of very diverse sources and trying to bring them together. And it's kind of a common thing, I think, for people who are interested in esotericism, but maybe who don't have academic training. They try to include everything. You know, they want to read everything and understand, you know, the way the whole world works through these different texts. It's a very interesting book. I mean, I think he has a little, at the beginning, he has a bit of his kind of autobiography. And it does really reveal that he was very interested as a kid in, or as a young person, in astrology and in ancient cultures and ancient languages. And that he also did have like a little religious group that he used to run, I guess at the time that Debbie would have been at the university in West Virginia.
Black Michael had simply asked Debbie for the date and time of her birth, and she'd apparently given it to him. In return, he gave her the plate.
Apparently, after he had made this plate for her, her father discovered it, and he called the police because he was very upset.
So he gave it to her to take home, did he?
Right. And I guess she had only tried to meet with him one time, and it really scared her off because she felt like he was part of a coven.
Okay.
And so her father called the police, and then they handed over the plate, and then she never had anything else to do with him, but she was super terrified of him, and she didn't want her identity to be known because she was afraid that he would find her. And I was like, can I just send you a picture of this plate? I mean, you haven't seen it in 50 years. She was like, yeah, go ahead and send it to my email. And I sent it to her, and she just looked at it. I mean, it was just, she just kept saying, wow, wow. Like, and she seems to think that there's a backside to the plate.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we thought there was a backside maybe for a while, but it seems in the FBI report that the back was blank, right?
If there is a backside to the plate, like, we're not able to see it. And as far as I can tell, like, with the people that I've reached out to, I don't think anyone knows what happened to it.
Keep in mind that Debbie had no way of knowing how to read the plate, so she never even knew what was on it.
She had no idea what any of it meant, and so I was asking her about certain points on the plate, and I said, so you see the part at the top where there's sort of like the circle with a plus sign in it, and it's above what looks like could be either antlers or eyebrows. She goes, oh no, those are horns. He had these protrusions that were above his eyes, and he always referred to them as his horns. She's like, I really think that this is like him putting himself on the plate.
Ah, wow.
It's hard to know how to address the claim that Black Michael supposedly had horns, or perhaps just slight protrusions of some sort that he played off as horns. Sarah and I still keep in touch with Jeff Fuller, our co-host on Merritt and Karen. He was around Morgantown at the time, and when Sarah relayed Debbie's mention of the horns, Jeff said it rang a bell, like he'd heard it before a long time ago. On the other hand, Michael Oscar McKee, aka Black Michael, actually has a Facebook page, and the image he has there does not readily show any horns or protrusions, so we're not sure what to think about all that. We are sure that Debbie does not take this plate lightly.
If we ever get the plate, she wants to destroy it.
Wow.
But she was kind of surprised because she was like, well, this was supposed to tell me like what my health was going to be for the rest of my life.
Huh.
He probably told her about the health part, but he left out the important things like Mephistopheles being on there and like what that the consequences possibly of putting a demon's name on that. And when I did tell her, she was not happy about it. And I think she pretty much doubled down. She didn't really want to have her name associated with it at all because she was terrified of Black Michael. And I don't know whether this warranted or not, but I know that it was a very difficult situation for her, one that she still remembers after 50 years. She's very concerned. Like, she doesn't ever want to have any contact with him at all. And she really does want to destroy the plate. Like, she does think that it has some kind of significance, maybe power even.
Much of Black Michael's book contains his ideas about spirituality and religion, but as Corshi noted, the first section contains an autobiography of sorts. Michael Oscar McKee was born on July 24th, 1947. He was baptized at Andrews Methodist Episcopal Church in Grafton, the church where Mother's Day was first celebrated in the United States. It was within walking distance of his house on Washington Street, where Black Michael says he first became aware of minute sparks, these flashes of light, quote, that I came to realize 60 years later as the Spirit of God. At 5 years old, Black Michael had what he describes as his first sexual experience in the shed beside his house with an 8-year-old girl. He never saw her again, and he says the experience, quote, scarred me for the rest of my life, as I've always had difficulty in my social relationships with women. Though it's unclear whether the scarring was from the event itself or never seeing her again, his upbringing was steeped in Christianity. His family had emigrated from Russia in 1910, which his mother only told him after he'd given her a music box as a gift that played this Russian folk song. All the teachers at Black Michael's Catholic school were Dominican nuns who wore a white habit with a long black veil. A priest with a heavy Irish brogue presided. In his preteen years, Black Michael's family moved from Grafton to Terra Alta to Bridgeport, where he was hit by a truck while riding a bicycle. He woke up a week later in a Clarksburg hospital. A doctor there told his mother that he would mentally have trouble with time, which, quote, would become an obsession on and off for the rest of my life. Later that year, his father died. He was 12 years old. As a young man, Black Michael planned to enter the Dominican priesthood, much like the friar version of Mephistopheles. And ironically, it was during this time that he first acquired his nickname, which turns out to have nothing to do with the occult. We asked Jeff to read some selected paragraphs from the book for us.
While I was a student at WVU, and later as a citizen of Morgantown, West Virginia, I came to be known as Black Michael. I didn't choose the name. It was given to me, initially because I wore all black. It was a habit I started in high school to lose weight. I wore a black suit, vest, shirt, and tie as a hot box to sweat the weight off. I went from 205 pounds to 155 in high school, and eventually down to 139 in college, before I started to regain weight.
There's also the fact that Black Michael was preparing himself to become a priest, and priests mostly wear black, so that's just what he had in his closet. In the book, he describes a pivotal moment in his departure from that path to the priesthood. He was talking with a friend about spiritual matters one day, when his friend asked,
"How do they know that what they relate in scripture and sermons is true? How do they know it actually happened that way?" My immediate and confident response was to begin with, "We are told," and I stopped. It occurred to me in that moment that we are told what to believe. And how did they know? They are told.
It was this idea that set him on his search through history and ancient scriptures. Black Michael didn't date much. He kept to himself, started drinking, doing recreational drugs. His sexual experiences were with prostitutes and, quote, easy women. He says he started teaching witchcraft and magic to see naked women. And in 1968, he met his wife in the bowling alley under the WVU Mountain Lair. He describes himself as a terrible husband, spending most of his time drinking and smoking with people between Morgantown and D.C. About this period of his life, he says,
"There were people around, but I was alone."
All the while, he kept building his library of magic and religion, and it was around this time that he would have met Debbie. One evening, after 4 years of marriage, Black Michael came back from drinking to find a Dear John letter. His wife wanted a divorce. He was furious, and out loud, he wished her dead. 2 weeks later, she was involved in a head-on automobile collision on her way to work. She survived for another 2 weeks before passing away. Black Michael stopped practicing magic, and for 20 years, he struggled daily with guilt, believing in his heart that he had cursed her and caused her death. After her death, he moved back to Morgantown and bought a house, along with the entire inventory of an occult bookstore from Florida. He used that inventory and his growing personal collection to open his own store in Sunnyside in Morgantown. It was called The Philosopher's Stone. The day before WVU's summer school started, Black Michael left a candle burning in the shop. Much of the business burned away. He wanted to revive the shop and rename it The Phoenix Bookstore, a reference to rising from the ashes, but he could no longer afford the insurance to reopen. In the years that followed, he spent much of his life at the then-new Herndon Kmart, where he started working 55 hours a week as a night man. He started at $3 per hour. 16 years later, he was still working the same job at a higher wage, in addition to working the counter of an Exxon station across the street. One night in 1994, Black Michael had an experience he called surrendering.
I had nothing to show for what I had done with my life. I was homeless, living in a van, and alone. I spoke with our Father. I recognized that I had failed with my life and turned over the guidance and control of my life to Him. I did not question whatever happened in my life. I accepted it. I believed it was for my benefit. I became an observer of cause and effect. I came to understand that the exterior life is a reflection of the interior life.
Black Michael's van was towed away by the county in 2006, and at age 59, he began a 2-year period of sleeping in the shed beside the gas station where he worked. He was kicked out when management changed in 2008. In November of 2010, he says he moved into the apartment where he currently lives, which he only describes as a one-bedroom inside the Beltway around Washington, D.C. In April of 2018, at age 71, he had open-heart surgery and was in the hospital for more than 6 weeks. The autobiography portion of his book ends with this paragraph.
All of my housing and storage consolidation plans were put on hold until probably next year, 2020 CE. The rewriting of this work has occupied my time, and even there, complications arose when a cataract rendered me blind in one eye, and fatigue has slowed the editing.
Black Michael is now 73 years old. Before we read his book, Black Michael was a sort of mythical horned figure whose name kept popping up in fantastical stories from the area. After this, he seems all too human. We haven't been able to get in touch with Black Michael. He doesn't seem to use his Facebook page anymore, and the phone numbers we've dug up are out of service. But if he's listening, or if someone who knows him is listening, we hope he'll get in touch. We'd love to speak with him and allow him to speak for himself. So, to summarize the decoding of the plate,
it really didn't have anything to do with the bodies, except that there were some like crazy coincidences regarding that. Like, she graduated the same year that Merritt and Karen did, and both of her parents worked in the Mineral Industries building, which is where the co-eds were last seen when they got into a car.
Yeah.
So there was just like all this weird stuff adding up. And I'm like, did you even know about the co-eds? And she was like, no, like my father was really strict and I didn't even know that that was going on. I didn't even know that these girls were missing. The final coincidence was that she and her father didn't really get along. He was an authoritarian. And so she and a friend actually hitchhiked out of the state. She doesn't even live in the state anymore. But like how got out was because she hitchhiked.
Wow, but she made it out safely, thank God. It's not directly linked to the murder, but I guess at least we've managed to cross off this box. And it does kind of reveal a very interesting aspect about what people were getting up to in the background. I think it's still a very interesting object. And if you ever get in contact with Black Michael, it'd be really interesting to learn more about how he decided to make this and, you know, why he decided to include the elements that he did and where he found them.
Well, I just can't thank you enough for all of your help in this. I mean, seriously, we would have been so in the dark about this plate, and you were able to decipher it in what, like less than 2 weeks? That was crazy.
Well, I think between us, we managed to do the whole thing in a very short period of time, you know, like I think it's about 2 weeks from us first getting in contact to you talking to Debbie.
Thank you so much, Corsi. It was so nice to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. Stay safe and healthy, guys. And thanks for your time.
Corsi has a podcast based around his project, Coptic Magical Papyri. Episodes cover topics related to ancient Egyptian, Greek, and Coptic magical traditions, as well as life and religion in the ancient Mediterranean in general. The podcast tackles questions like who were the ancient magicians and what was their role in society and how is the study of Coptic magic relevant today, other than this plate, obviously. If that sounds like something you'd be interested in, you can find Coptic Magical Papyri on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and Podcast Addict. Thanks so much to Debbie for being willing to help us with this story. Season 3 of Appalachian Mysteria is now in the works, so keep that subscription locked in. Visit Appalachian Mysteria on Facebook to stay up to date and check out the plate. Our Season 1 music is written and recorded by John Smithers, Nick Larson, Annie Stroud, and Nathan Snyder. A quick bit of belated news. Sadly, the room where this Merritt and Karen theme song was recorded burned to the ground last year. It was in a warehouse along the Monongahela River, where a huge number of Morgantown bands have played and practiced over the years. It was integral to the music scene we tried to showcase in Season 1, and its loss deserves a mention. Everyone stay safe out there.